Today, this is Thursday, July the 10th, 2014. We are in Natick, Massachusetts, and this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Maureen Sullivan. Our cameraman is Dan McDermott of Natick Pegasus, and we are privileged to have with us today Paul Foley. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Maureen.
May I ask when you were born?
Yes, November 18th, 1954.
And where were you born?
Natick, Massachusetts at Leonard Morse Hospital.
And where do you currently live?
Coronado, California.
Your marital status?
Married.
Do you have children?
Two boys. Sean is 29 and Jack is 18.
And tell us what Natick was like growing up.
Basically like a 1950s, early 60s TV show. Always doing something. Never a dull moment. Sometimes a little drama, but not too much. But it was fun. I remember just being engaged all the time in either school or sports or just playing with friends outside.
Now, you're the third member of the Foley family to be recording an interview for the project.
Yes.
Your father, Francis, a World War II veteran, and your older brother, James,
a
Marine Corps veteran of Vietnam. What was that like for you?
Well, I wouldn't recall my dad's service other than the fact that he didn't talk a lot about it. And when he did, it wasn't a very pleasant conversation for him. Jim, I remember distinctly, he and my other brother Dan also deployed to Vietnam as a Marine. Jim was there 67 to 68, he was 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines. Jimmy was a machine gunner and obviously had some horrific times. Spent a good part of his time there in combat on a daily basis, which that's quite a feat if you think about it. Getting shot at and shooting back every day, that's to come through that is pretty remarkable.
Right.
For me, I was a little bit, I was pretty young, so I was impressionable, but I always held my two older brothers in the highest esteem.
All right. And you went to St. Pat's.
I did.
In Coolidge Junior High School.
Yes, I did.
And Natick High.
Yes.
And what year did you graduate?
1973 from Natick High School.
And before the interview, you mentioned that you entered the military in 1979. What did you do between graduating from high school and heading into the military?
Initially, I got into construction with Jim, my oldest brother. And I recall he and I were working one of the projects that he had gotten me into. And we were in a trench that was pretty deep, well over our heads, and there was very little shoring, if any at all, and we were putting in some 3-foot drain line, storm drain line. And I remember him looking at me saying, "Do you really think that you're going to do this for the rest of your life?" And it really made me think. So I worked a couple more construction jobs as a laborer and then finally got an apprenticeship as an electrician. So I did that till 1977. I managed to get my journeyman's license in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, and subsequently get my master's license in California in 1988.
Okay. Where and when did you enter the military?
Out of the Framingham Recruiting Office, I went through the MEP station in Boston in 1979,
okay.
In April of 79.
Why did you join at the time?
Well, given the events of the day, I honestly thought that the United States was on its path to war with the Iranians over the hostage crisis that lasted well over 400 days. And I saw that, I thought the writing was on the wall that Mr. Jimmy Carter's days were over and Ronald Reagan would be our next president. So I kind of figured I'd get a jump on it.
Okay. And what branch did you join?
Well, initially I approached the Navy due to my construction experience because the Navy has a unit that does construction for contingency construction for not only the Navy but for the Marine Corps, and they spend a lot of time on the ground. And I wasn't real keen on getting on board a ship. And since I had construction knowledge, I thought I would fit fairly well into the Seabees of the Naval Construction Force. So eventually I got my way after threatening the Navy recruiter that I was going to go talk to the Marine Corps gunnery sergeant if I didn't get what I wanted.
Oh, boy. Did family or friends join the service when you did?
No. I was the only one.
Where were you sent for basic?
Great Lakes, Illinois. Yeah.
And tell us what that was like.
Cold. It was chilly when we got up there. It was a late spring arriving, if you will. So I recall getting there. There was still lots of snow on the deck in Illinois, up north of Chicago. And not only that, there was a very, very cold wind that lasted for a good month. And then on a graduation day in June, I recall standing in ranks and just getting blistered because the sun was a beautiful, bright, sunny, warm day. And we stood out there for about 3 hours, and I just got, I looked like a lobster after I was, done.
Is there anything else you liked or disliked about it?
Boot camp?
Yeah.
Or
basic.
We did a lot of marching. Not a lot of physical training, which I was kind of disappointed with, having been somewhat of an athlete when I was in school. If anything, that was probably my major. I wasn't a very good student. We didn't do a lot of physical activity. We learned about the Navy, obviously, but a lot of that was shipboard stuff and things that I hopefully wouldn't have a lot to do with as a construction guy.
Right. Now, of course, you had already had construction experience. Did you receive any other kind of specialized training beyond basic?
Yes, I went through construction electrician A school in Gulfport, Mississippi. Right down on the Gulf Coast, right next to Biloxi.
What was that like?
Hot and humid, but I like hot and humid, so I didn't mind. There was three or four phases of instruction. One of my favorites was the utility line construction, where you actually erect power poles and put up all the hardware and the cross arms and hang transformers and string lines and pull secondary conductors and actually energize a pole field. It's pretty interesting. So
yeah, well, you're not talking just a single telephone pole, but the big towers, or
no? These wouldn't be transmission towers. They would be utility poles, not telephone poles. But our project was, in order to graduate, we had to complete this particular power project.
And how long did the course take?
Oh, boy, that was 12 weeks long.
12 weeks.
Yeah.
What happened after Gulfport?
Gulfport, I went out to California to, I had a military training class that I had to go through. And then I shipped out for Subic Bay in the Philippines to report to my first duty station. And that was at CBMU 302 in Subic Bay.
Now, before the Philippines, is this like your first time overseas?
Yes.
And aside from Gulfport and Great Lakes, was that your first time away from Massachusetts?
No. I had actually worked a project, construction project down in Florida.
Okay. But this is your first time overseas, and tell us what that was like.
It was interesting, to say the least.
Okay, what time are we talking about now? 1980?
No, this would have been still 1979. I think I got there the first week of November of 79. Mm-hmm. And then I want to say a week later, I was in on the island of Diego Garcia in the middle of the Indian Ocean for my first deployment. CBMU 302 would send a contingency of people to perform maintenance functions within a camp that the Seabees lived in.
Uh-huh.
So since we were a maintenance unit, our job was to maintain all the ice machines, all the air conditioning, refrigeration, all the power, primary and secondary, within the camp, and just basically keep things running for the rest of the Seabees that were on the island doing road projects or runway projects. There was a big pier project going on as well.
So how many Seabees were on the island at the time?
1,600 at the time. And we were the only people there.
Wow.
There was some British people, but they were all military as well.
And you're in the middle of the Indian Ocean?
Yes. They call it the Footprint of Freedom. If you look it up on Google Maps, it's in the British Indian Ocean territories. And it is dead set in the middle of the IO, of the Indian Ocean.
How long were you stationed there?
I actually came back from there the first time in May, June of 1980, and then a month later I went back again. So I spent most of 1980 over there, and then I went for a third time in 1981 before I went back to CBMU 302 and stayed there for my last about 7 months, and then I transferred back to the U.S.
So you got pretty used to the Indian Ocean.
I did, yeah.
What was it like, the overall experience?
You know, it's a really beautiful island, and if you were to go to there today, the of course the U.S. Navy's still there, but the one of the biggest complaints that anybody had back in that when I went was that there was no girls, no women, and now there's a 40-60 ratio of 60% women that man the island to against 40% that are guys that are over doing their job. Yeah. So, but the beaches are beautiful. The lagoon is deep. There's quite a bit of wildlife. It's a little dangerous at times. There's very large eels, sharks, stonefish, lionfish, things like that. Yeah. All sorts of little creatures that can just put a hurting on your day.
But right.
If you were careful, nobody bothered you. So.
And what rank were you at the time?
First time I went over there, I was an E3. And the last time I was there, I was an E5.
Okay. So now you're back in the United States. Tell us what happened next.
I went to U.S. Navy Diver School to be an underwater construction diver.
Tell us what that was like.
That was another 12 weeks that was pretty intense. Diving physiology, all the dive tables that teach you about recompression, how to get rid of the nitrogen in your blood and all that stuff. So, because anytime you're breathing compressed air under pressure, it increases the nitrogen in your bloodstream. So,
which causes the bends.
Yes, it can. Or it could get worse. Mm-hmm. If you come to the surface too quickly, it could be a gas embolism in your bloodstream, or worse yet, you could actually burst your lungs, which would be bad. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a diving construction?
There's two teams, so underwater construction team one and two. The UCT-2 is in Port Hueneme on the west coast, and UCT-1 is in Little Creek, Virginia on the east coast.
And what is the purpose of the team?
They do a lot of waterfront construction. They do a lot of fleet mooring inspections and placements. They do some underwater demolition at times, mainly just removing debris or making way for new construction. There was, I was introduced to them on the island of Diego Garcia because there was a big pier project going on at the time. And all the underwater work that was happening with the concrete forms for the pilings, they were doing that particular function. So it's pretty interesting.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right, 12 weeks are over. You passed, I hope.
I did. I graduated April 30 on my mother's birthday in 1982. That's where I met my wife, Maria, too. Mm. She was she worked at the Navy Exchange on base.
And where was this again?
In Coronado.
Coronado, okay.
California, at the Naval Amphibious Base.
Okay. Tell us what happened next.
Well, I went to a battalion. I went to Naval Mobile Construction Battalion 4 and subsequently deployed to Okinawa, Japan.
Back over the Pacific you go.
Yes, yep. And Okinawa was different. Mm-hmm. It was okay, a little more built up than, of course, Diego Garcia. A little more modern, if you will, of a country. And there was more things to see, but I didn't get a lot of time to see many things because it was either one, very expensive, or two, we just didn't have the time off. We used to work about 6 days. Yeah, we averaged about 6 days a week. It was a pretty rare week that we
had. And what were your duties?
I worked a power project. So I really didn't do a lot of diving. But ran a power line project in camp. Oh, gosh, I forget the name of the camp, but I know it was down south near the city of Naha, which is the capital city of Okinawa.
Okay. And how long were you stationed in Okinawa?
That was eight and a half months. Mm-hmm. That deployment. Months.
Tell us what happened next.
Well, we came home from Okinawa, and my chief asked me if I wanted to be assigned to the regiment to be a military training instructor. And I said, sure, what do I have to do? And he says, well, you got to pass the interview with the Marine Corps staff that's over there, because CB battalions rely on the Marine Corps to provide their basic combat skill and infantry training, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I, after I was accepted by the Marine staff, I became an M60 machine gun instructor. It was fun. It's a great weapon.
First you're diving, now you're running a machine gun. Okay. Did you have to be taught?
I had to learn the gun and learn obviously how to do a presentation with the weapon and then be able to convey that information to others. So ultimately it was my last function there is the one of the senior machine gun instructors. It was for me to teach my instructor staff that was going to replace me. You know, basically everything that I knew. So, it was an enjoyable time. We'd spent a lot of time in the field, a lot of time doing field training exercises.
And where was this?
Out of Port Hueneme in California.
Okay, back in California.
Yes.
And how long did this take?
That lasted for about 15, 16 months.
And this takes us to about what,
1984, because from there I went to the Naval Construction Training Center in Port Hueneme, where I was an instructor for C School and then what they called special construction battalion trainings, which were little mini classes on different subjects for the construction electrician trade or the schoolhouse. And later I was able to get on the book and teach C School, which is an advanced class.
Right. And what was your rank at now?
I was a first class petty officer when I got there,
mm-hmm.
and which I was E6.
Yeah.
And when I left there in 88, I was a chief petty officer.
Okay. In the meantime, in California, when did you get married?
1983.
Okay.
Yeah, December of 1983. And Sean was born in 1985.
Okay. So now you're out in California, you have learned how to dive, you've learned how to run a machine gun, you've been teaching people in construction school. Tell us a little bit about what U.S. military presence was like at that time in the early and mid-80s.
Mm.
It's like a little after post-Vietnam.
There was, it was the Reagan era, so mm-hmm. we saw some advances in the Department of Defense overall.
Mm-hmm.
I think President Reagan put a great deal of emphasis on a strong military,
mm-hmm.
so he made sure that. Never got to his 600-ship Navy that he was working towards, but mm-hmm. He did bring back the battle wagons for a while, and I don't think they decommed until after the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
So, and those were pretty impressive. If you ever seen one out to sea, they're it's a big boat,
mm-hmm.
and they 16-inch guns can do a lot of damage if you give them the opportunity.
We're also heading into what turned out to be the latter part of the Cold War.
Yes.
And there were, of course, the incidents in Panama and Grenada.
Right.
Were you involved in either?
No, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I say that only because that's why I joined. I figured, mm-hmm. okay, if I got to do this, I might as well go all the way. It's kind of like practicing for the big game and you don't get to play.
All right. You know? Well, tell us what happened next.
Well, from the Naval Construction Training Center, I went to, mm-hmm. Again, in Port Hueneme, but this was an aviation command. It was Naval Support Force Antarctica. So
cool.
Yeah. So I was actually assigned to the winter over crew, which typically spends 12 to 13 months down on the ice, as they call it,
mm-hmm.
on the continent of Antarctica at McMurdo Station.
Ah, good old McMurdo.
Yes. Have you met others that have been there?
Not directly, but I've studied Antarctica off and on for a few years, and I've heard a lot about McMurdo.
It's one of the bigger bases down there,
mm-hmm.
Run by the National Science Foundation.
Right.
And the Navy was in a supporting role to the National Science Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was interesting. We were in the process of turning over a large part of the Navy's responsibility for the maintenance and upkeep of McMurdo Station to a civilian contractor.
Mm-hmm.
So, by and large, our crew size for the winter would have been, on the military side, would have been up to 60,
mm-hmm.
but this time it was, for 88, 89, I think it was half that. It was probably
right.
35 people,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and we were the 34th winter over crew. So from October of 88 till November of 89, came home just in time for my birthday. Yeah. So and that was interesting. I was the chief for the Seabees that were down there. There was about 14 of us in our shop.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some eventful days. I remember one day we had an incident at the ice pier. And the ice pier literally was a giant ice cube
uh-huh.
that was lashed together with steel cables. And we would do a lift to create another layer. after wire rope had been laid out between these bollards. And unfortunately, one of my equipment operators, while cleaning the dirt cap off before the right at winter or summer closeout, so it's beginning the winter season, whatever dirt we put on the top of it to keep it from melting, we've got to scrape all of that off and get ready to prepare for future 6-inch lifts with more wire rope in between. One of my operators actually went through the ice while she was, an EO2. Her name was Laura Moody. She was in a completely enclosed cab on a D8 or a D9 dozer. It was one of the largest bulldozers we had.
Right.
And she had just finished making a push of dirt off the pier. And when she put it in reverse, the edge of the pier gave way. The dozer slid to the right and just went straight to the bottom. So she was at right at about 30 feet where she was in the cab. And this was the only bulldozer that we had that had a glass top.
Right.
But she had glass on both sides, front and back. And as those pieces of glass were overcome by the bottom pressure, they collapsed inboard.
Oh my.
But it also pushed the glass up. And she said she rode an air bubble all the way to the surface. She didn't get wet until she was on the surface of the
water. You mean she survived?
Yes, she survived.
Wow.
Yeah. And I went to, that was a Thursday. I'll remember that like it was yesterday. And they had just finished a little chapel. And that was a Thursday afternoon. I went to the chapel every Thursday afternoon after that. Every afternoon, religiously.
Anything else from your time in Antarctica?
Yes. Our runway crew that prepared the sea ice runway landed, built the runway long enough to have the U.S. Air Force fly the very first C-5 mission into McMurdo Station and landed on sea ice. Of course, the sea ice was about 10 to 12 feet thick, I think, was the average.
Yeah.
And at the time, the only other Air Force plane that had flown down there that was a jet was the C-141. The C-5, while larger, actually, since it had so many wheels in its undercarriage, displaced less ground pressure per square inch than the C-141 did. So it was beneficial to the mission. The first, I want to say the first C-5 mission brought in three or four of the Navy helicopters that would support the National Science Foundation.
Right.
So they brought in a ton of gear on that first one, and then subsequently they flew in two or three other missions and brought most of the rest of the squadron's assets with them. So, and the first flight in, the first C-5, was landed by the commanding general of Pacific Air Forces. He was a 3-star general.
Yow.
Yeah, so he was pretty stoked.
All right, Antarctica. Antarctica. Anything else?
No, I can't say that it was an unhappy day to leave there. You know, it was that was pretty exciting.
Okay.
And I made a lot of very good friends down there, especially my friends that live in New Zealand, because the Kiwis, as they call themselves, they ran our cargo operations at the airfield, and so I get to spend some time in New Zealand before I came back to the States. Spent that time with a friend of mine by the name of Gus Warner and his wife, Susan, and their two boys. So that was about 5 days.
Nice.
Yeah, so we had a good time.
All right, back in this country?
Just for a little bit. Picked up Maria and Sean from Port Hueneme, and we headed north to Adak, Alaska.
Another cold place.
In the Aleutian Islands, yeah. Yep. It was a Naval Air Station, so it was that was different. I worked at the Public Works Department, and I had four different shops: the boiler shop, the washer dryer shop. I had all the interior wiring shop, and let me see what else. I know I did something else. Oh, our shop provided electricians to the power production side, power production and power line maintenance for the distribution of power throughout the island.
Now, how far along on the Aleutians were you stationed?
ADAC's about two-thirds of the way down.
Okay.
From the mainland.
So you're actually fairly close to both Russia and Japan.
Yes, because there's probably four or five other smaller islands that are after ADAC that extend out into the, I believe that's the Bering Sea, isn't it?
Yeah. So you're actually up there at a pretty interesting time, the fall of communism.
Yeah, and we got alerted quite often, because by this time it's 1990.
Right.
We used to get, when I stood watch on the quarterdeck, we would get flash message traffic alerting us that Soviet aircraft were approaching our vicinity, and they were always intercepted either by Air Force fighters that were out of Shemya Island, which is even farther out on the chain than we are, or from aircraft, U.S. aircraft that were flying out of Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage.
Anything else about your time in the Aleutians?
The big mission there was keeping the airfield open. So our equipment operators did a lot of plowing during the wintertime, and we did some projects. It seemed like it was always snowing. The wind was always blowing. It was or it was always raining. The commanding officer would at times call Sunshine Liberty if there was a particularly nice day, and if the sun was shining, he would authorize the department heads to cut their people loose for the remainder of the day. Otherwise, you were working most of the time.
Right. Well, what would happen during Sunshine Liberty? Just bask?
Just try and go out and suck up some vitamin D and a little bit of warmth.
And how long were you stationed in the Aleutians?
That was two years, 6 months. Yeah, about two and a half years.
And how did your wife and son like it?
It wasn't until about halfway through the tour of duty that Maria actually started to enjoy herself, because she was she didn't have any friends up there initially, so. And she can be a little shy at times. Mm-hmm. So we had some neighbors who were very friendly. And subsequently, Maria became very fast friends with a couple of our neighbors. And that was a good thing. Yeah.
Okay. Tell us what happened after the Aleutians.
I went to NMCB 5, Naval Mobile Construction Battalion 5, out of Port Hueneme, California.
Back to California.
I'm telling you. Yeah. I made two deployments with NMCB 5, the first one down to Panama in the Canal Zone. We were at Rodman Naval Station, which is on the south end, which is on the Pacific side. And we did a big camp it's going to be some kind of housing project for transient folks, I believe. But it was basically like a big trailer park, but more permanent than not. And my CBs were in charge of basically building that up, and they did a great job.
Nice.
They did a really good job. I remember that when it rained down there, it rained really, really hard, and it would come down in droves. Literally, you thought the ocean had just jumped into the sky and it was falling on you.
But at least it wasn't freezing.
No, it wasn't cold at all. No, not at all. And there was very large bugs there. Very large. And then my next deployment with NRCB-5, I went to Pohang, Korea. South Korea.
Oh, South Korea. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's on the east coast of Korea, just about a third of the way up the east coast from Busan.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The big port facility. And Pohang was also a port facility, but it was home to the POSCO Steelworks.
Mm-hmm.
POSCO Steel was, at the time, it was the second largest steel producer in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Only outgunned by some outfit in France, but POSCO was on a growth scale.
Right.
And I remember that anytime they smelted iron ore and produced the ingots,
mm-hmm.
There was always about an inch to 2 inches of ash that would fall on our camp, just like a blanket of snow. Not big on the EPA over
uh-huh.
there.
Mm-hmm.
Not at the time, they weren't anyway. So, and that was, what, 94.
Okay. And what were your duties when you were in South Korea?
We had a number of projects to do. Mm-hmm. We were at a Marine Corps camp, and they were closely associated with the ROC 1st Marine Division. So that's the Republic of Korea 1st Marine Division. And the U.S. Marines always maintained a very friendly relationship with them. They do a lot of combined training together.
Mm-hmm.
So the Marines had a camp there, and we did a number of construction projects for them.
Okay. What happened after that?
Let's see. Came back to California.
Mm-hmm.
And packed up. I had 15 years in by this time. I packed up and went to Gulfport, Mississippi, where I was the construction electrician school director at the Naval Construction Training Center. So back to the instructor
mm-hmm.
bit.
And how long were you stationed in Gulfport?
95 to 97.
Okay. Anything about your experiences there?
That was pretty interesting. I actually made senior chief while I was down there.
Senior chief, okay.
And I went there as the construction electrician school director, and then mm-hmm. I became the Bravo Company chief, and later the Bravo Company, and then
mm-hmm.
Bravo Company commander. And then we changed our names because we had combined with another company. So we became the Advanced Schools Company. So I was the Advanced Schools Company commander, which all that meant was more paperwork, So, but it was an enjoyable tour. I enjoyed the people that I worked with.
Alrighty, so 2 years in Gulfport. Tell us what happened next.
From there, I had an interview while I was still in Gulfport with a lieutenant commander by the name mm-hmm. of Bob Curia. And Bob had been the staff engineer at the Naval Special Warfare Command staff.
Uh-huh.
And he was putting together two teams of Seabees to support Navy SEALs. So he asked me if I wanted to be the senior enlisted guy for the West Coast team.
Uh-huh.
And I talked with Maria about it for about 10 minutes because she said, well, you're going to do what you want anyway. And I said, well, don't you want to go back to California? She goes, I don't care.
Yeah.
You tell me what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, we're going. So I talked to Mr. Commander Curia that morning,
mm-hmm.
told him, hey, we're all in. So I had another 2 or 3 months, I think, left in Gulfport, and off we went back to the West Coast. My first time in San Diego, outside of dive school.
Right. So now you're involved with the Navy SEALs.
Yes. Yeah, that was a bit of a challenge because there was mm-hmm. only, there was 13 of us on the original mm-hmm. team. And the idea was we would be the K-2 camp specialists, if you will, and relieve the SEALs of any duties of either establishing a camp or doing any of their forward logistics, so they could basically combat or concentrate on their combat missions.
Right.
So our job was to basically take care of all the rudimentary stuff that that goes along with deploying a force to the field in order to do the job.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, well, one of our first projects was we built this huge camp in back in Korea, in Chinhae, which is just to the west of Busan, formerly Pusan. So Chinhae is the naval presence of the U.S. and the ROC Navy, the combined headquarters. So we built a 250-man camp there for a very large exercise that went off pretty well. We did that 3 or 4 years running and pulled it off every year. Not only we did it there, but we also did it a couple other places, a few times in this in the, one of the Gulf states, either Qatar or Kuwait in the Persian Gulf. And also in Africa, in Kenya.
Wow. So
the one in Kenya was a little lower key, but it's still, the guys went in there, and the camp, or the space that they were going to occupy was overrun by a tribe of baboons, or whatever you call them. What are they, a congress of baboons, I think? Yeah, so they had to get rid of those animals first. That proved to be a bit of a challenge.
Okay.
So, but they moved in and got everything cleaned up, and it was quite a bit of a cleanup too.
You're overrun by baboons. Yeah. They're not the neatest animals.
No, not at all. so there, that's that was some of our guys' work. So we had another team that supported. We basically broken up into the PACOM theater, the CENTCOM theater, and the Korea piece, because those were the areas of focus at the time. So the PACOM guy or guys were challenged for a big part, because there was only two of them, and they leveraged a lot of different things, but they always pulled it off. They always pulled it off.
Wow.
So it was pretty challenging. But interesting. Mm-hmm. And I did that from, 97 to 2001. And then I was on shore duty for a little while.
Yeah.
From 2000, April of 2001 till February of 2004. At the Naval Leadership Training Unit. I initially went there as a Master Chief. As an E9 and as a facilitator. Mm-hmm. So you're not an instructor, you're basically trying to get people to contribute to the curriculum vice just spitting out certain lesson plans. So you want to get everybody's involvement, which is, it's a lot like instructing, so it wasn't, it wasn't that difficult. But then later I was the Command Master Chief there, so.
Okay. And was this back in California?
Yes, it was. It was in San Diego. So no movement involved.
That's good.
And I honestly thought I was going to retire out of there. Mm-hmm. And I got a call from my detailer, who's the job assignments guy. And he said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, I thought I was going to retire." And he says, "Well, would you like your old job back at Naval Special Warfare?" And I said, "Heck yeah." So I did that from 2004 till I retired in 2009.
Okay, I'm going to step back just a little bit. And to what were you doing September 11, 2001?
I remember I was drinking a cup of coffee on the couch watching the news, and the first plane had just hit the first tower. And when the second plane hit the second tower, what was it, 15 minutes later?
Right.
I told Maria, I said, get ready for this, because we're going to war over with somebody over mm-hmm. this. This isn't an accident. Initially, when the first tower was hit, you know, people were opinionating that, oh, it was just an accident, you know, it was a horrible accident, but mm-hmm. it was just an accident. Well, you knew it wasn't an accident, especially after that second one hit. Mm-hmm. So.
And of course, a couple of years later, war in Iraq.
Yes.
War in Afghanistan. And you spent some time over there, too.
I spent some time in Iraq, both times with SEAL Team 3.
And tell us about that experience.
That was interesting. I actually, mm-hmm. I worked like I was a trooper again, mm-hmm. you know, if you will. If I was like, I was a Master Chief, but I was helping get the job done along with everybody else. Mm-hmm. So, because we didn't have enough people to be ordering others around, because mm-hmm. there was nobody else there to do it. So I lost a lot of weight, which was good, because mm-hmm. I could have used that.
Right. You said you had two deployments?
Yes. The first one was from, let me see, I want to say September of 2004 to May of 2005.
Okay.
And then the next one was in 2006. And I left the day after St. Patrick's Day. Mm-hmm. I was on the East Coast for St. Patrick's Day, and I left the following day. I was in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and got over there a little bit early, because we were doing a big move from the camp that the team had been mm-hmm. in prior, around the Baghdad airport.
Mm-hmm.
And we were moving west into Anbar province, and so we moved to Camp Fallujah. And there was a little bit of a sticking point, because mm-hmm. the roads were frequently IED'd, or you mm-hmm. know, there was always a chance of somebody, something nefarious mm-hmm. happening.
Now, you've been in CBs now for about 25 years up to this point. And was this your first time in a war zone?
Yes.
And what was your reaction, feelings, experience?
It was a lot of excitement uh-huh. combined with moments of sheer terror.
Okay. And you had actually sent me a little clip of a convoy,
yes,
undergoing an attack from an IED.
Yes, yes, that was actually from 2006.
2006, okay.
Yes, and we were conducting several road movements, if you will, mm-hmm. from Fallujah to an air base, which was even further west, that we had to get to in order mm-hmm. to do our rotation with the team that was relieving us.
Mm-hmm.
And that video is all infrared. Mm. It's kind of grainy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But the video is called, they call it Intel Surveillance and Reconnaissance, ISR.
Mm-hmm.
And that was provided to us by a video feed called Tiger Shark. That was it was a UAV.
Mm-hmm.
And that UAV was supposed to be watching the road to let us know that, hey, there might be an IED right there.
Mm-hmm.
We never got that call. So subsequently, our lead truck triggered device. I was in mm-hmm. the second vehicle in that
right.
in that movement. So it was a good thing, too, the way that they had placed they had stacked two artillery rounds,
mm-hmm.
but they put them in backwards. So most of the explosion went away from the road, vice coming right across the road.
Right.
But it threw up a hellacious fireball and mm-hmm. just dust everywhere. It was incredible.
Okay. And of course, you must have been wearing full battle.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Plus we were all driving on night vision. So, uh-huh. Yeah. We We always drove fast,
mm-hmm.
and always at night, and always blacked out. So no lights anywhere,
mm-hmm.
and it makes it a bit of a challenge.
Right.
Especially when you have a big fireball in front of you.
So. Really? I mean, this is also, again, based on your experiences, you've been Antarctica, Okinawa, you were all over the place. How did Iraq compare to your other experiences?
Dusty, mm-hmm. and I remember quite vividly when mm-hmm. we left Iraq. I got off the plane in Germany
mm-hmm.
at Ramstein Air Base, and as soon as I stepped out of the plane, the thing that hit me the most was just the overwhelming smell of the green, of the forest
mm-hmm.
that surrounded that place. It was one of the best things ever.
Mm-hmm.
Really. It was awesome.
Okay. Whew. Tell us what happened next.
Well, I had intended on going back with Team 3 in 2008. Subsequently, I was told by the Group 1 Master Chief,
mm-hmm.
Naval Special Warfare Group 1 was our immediate superior
right.
to the command that I worked at. So the Group 1 Master Chief told me that I was taking the job of Command Master Chief at my command. So I did that for 6 months until the next appointed Command Master Chief came in, who is also another guy from Massachusetts, by mm-hmm. the way. His name is Rich Puglisi. He's a
uh-huh.
he's a Navy SEAL, and typically at the command that I currently work at, and it's also the command that I retired from.
Mm-hmm.
We have four or five positions that are normally held by Navy SEALs. So our commanding officer is a supply officer.
Mm-hmm.
Our executive officer is a SEAL.
Mm-hmm.
Our Command Master Chief is a SEAL. Our Combat Systems Officer is a SEAL. And we also have an Operations Officer. He is a SEAL.
Mm-hmm.
And we have an Operations Master Chief, who is also a SEAL.
All right.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Fun people to know. They really are.
All right. So you're back from Iraq. You're back in California.
Yes.
You were a Command Master Chief for 6 months, and you retired in 2009.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yes.
What have you been doing these days?
Well, Maureen, I work for the command that I mm-hmm. retired from. They actually called me back into a civilian position
mm-hmm.
to work in the operations office. The commanding officer that I worked for at the time of my retirement had actually talk to me mm-hmm. about the potential for this particular position coming up, because
mm-hmm.
He envisioned having a continuity in place, if you will, within the operations shop. Because prior to that, it seemed like every time we had a new operations master chief or a new operations officer roll in, the corporate knowledge went out the door, so mm-hmm. things had to be relearned.
Right.
So subsequently, my job is to say, yeah, that might sound like a good idea, but we tried that a couple of years ago. It didn't work, so mm-hmm. that's why we do it this way.
Institutional memory.
Yes. Well, I try to be. As mm-hmm. long as I as long as I can do that, I guess I'm wanted.
And what rank did you retire?
As a Master Chief.
As a Master Chief.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you mentioned you have two sons. Did either son get interested in the military?
My youngest.
Your youngest.
Currently is mm-hmm. hoping to join the Navy.
Okay.
That's Jack.
Okay. And I have your personal sheet here, and you have medals. Tell us about the two Bronze Stars you won.
Those were meritorious awards.
Mm-hmm.
They're Bronze Stars because they were earned in a combat zone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like I was in a run and gun fight every day.
Right.
You know? I didn't do any of that. Although the only times we were ever shot at, I mm-hmm. could never shoot back because mm-hmm. I was either driving a truck mm-hmm. or I was a passenger in a truck. And that's aside from, you know, being in a camp or being somewhere where you're getting what they call indirect fire, which mm-hmm. is either mortar or rockets. And it's kind of hard to shoot back at those.
You
have to determine the point of origin and mm-hmm. be fairly accurate with your return fire.
Mm-hmm. In the years that you served with the CBs, you've been practically all over the world. And I know you were kept very, very busy while you were on your tours. Did you ever have a chance to kind of check out the culture?
Yes. As a matter of mm-hmm. fact, in Okinawa, mm-hmm. I went to one of their, I guess it would be referred to as an indigenous wildlife show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At one of their cultural centers.
Mm-hmm.
And we met an assorted variety of snakes and other reptilians.
Mm-hmm.
There was a snake over there called the habu. It's a poisonous viper, which you didn't want to come across one of those.
Mm-hmm.
But they pretty much kept to themselves. They hibernated quite a bit.
Right.
And normally they were nocturnal creatures, so you really didn't have to worry about them mm-hmm. too much.
What about when you were in Iraq? Did you have a chance to interact with the local people?
Just a few. Not many. There were some people that worked on the base.
Right.
That were fully vetted locals that didn't try to do anything bad. So I got to know some of those fellas pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But not to any great length. But mm-hmm. I came to know that I think intrinsically, people all over the world, they just want to do right by their families,
mm-hmm.
and at least normal people want to do right by their families and live peacefully for the most part. And then there's always the assorted whack jobs out there that just create hate and distemper for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Have you joined any military service organizations or veterans groups?
I'm actually a member of the I'm a life member of the CB Veterans of America.
Okay.
And there's a VFW in our town in Coronado, which I've been putting off my life membership with them until I turn 60, so that's coming right around the corner, so I think I'll do that.
Paul, how important has it been for you to serve in the military?
Maureen, I would do it absolutely all over again.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. It gave me a chance to see many things, many places. Wasn't always one of those pit stops on a jet set place mm-hmm. to go, mm-hmm. but they were always interesting and they were always, it was always pretty cool. I recall doing a diving trip while I was in Okinawa. Mm. And we took a ferry ride out to the Karamas Islands. And if my history is correct, the Karamas Islands were the initial staging point for the U.S. invasion of Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
So those islands were captured initially by either Marines or Army infantry, one of the two, or maybe both. And it was a group of three islands that form this U-shaped channel. Very strong currents that ran between the islands, but the islands themselves, they were a perfect logistic hub for the assault on the beaches. So after the war, it became a national underwater park for the Japanese.
Mm.
And the wildlife that's down there is absolutely incredible. And once you get past the surface current underneath. Once you're down about 20 feet, you can hang out on the bottom. There's very little movement of the water,
mm-hmm.
And it's gorgeous. It's absolutely mm-hmm. gorgeous. We took some dried mackerel down there with us, and to feed other fish.
Oh, okay.
And they are cannibals. They all you had to do was hold up one of these dried mackerels, and you would have literally thousands of, it looked like a rainbow of color just swirling about your head because they were all coming in for a bite of this mackerel. And we had a Japanese guide with us that brought us over to this pretty good-sized hole in the seafloor.
Uh-huh.
Looked like a manhole, literally, without the manhole cover. And he cautioned us to stay back, and he had told us on the surface, he said, no cameras.
No cameras.
No pictures of this particular animal.
Uh-huh.
Because he dangled a dried mackerel over the hole, and an eel came out of that hole that literally filled the hole. And to me, he looked like he was the size of a manhole.
Wow.
And he brought him out about a good 6 feet, and he was still coming.
Nice.
There wasn't any end to him in sight. So he was a big, big animal.
Okay. Paul, is there anything else you'd like to say for this interview?
Maureen, I can't thank you, the Morse Institute and your crew, for doing this. I think it's a great thing. I'm glad that you got a chance to talk to my dad and my brother Jim. Hopefully you'll get a chance to talk to my brother Dan. I'll see him tomorrow, so I'll tell him to pump you up.
And,
really, thank you.
Okay,
thank you
thank
very
you.
Much. This has been great.
Mm-hmm.